Welcome to chapter 42 of Only Half the Story podcast. This is where we interview the most passionate of the passionate people of those who are on the pursuit of achieving their goals and dreams. On today's episode, we have Cameron Steiner, and he is a fellow University of Arizona alum, and he's got the entrepreneurial spirit that'll just make you think outside of the box. It was a pleasure connecting with Cameron, hearing his story, and really digging into his big plans that he's got going on. So please help me welcome Cameron Steiner to the show. My name is Andrew Haft. This is Only Half the Story podcast, and let chapter 42 begin. One quick side note before chapter 42 begins. Only Half the Story podcast for pennies is alive and well. Every time you listen to an episode of this show, three whole pennies will be donated to safespace.org, an effort to support mental health. So please help us reach our goal of 100,000 downloads. That's $3,000 in effort to support this great cause. So enough with the introduction and let chapter 42 begin.
Make her go live somewhere random or find another roommate, or so it just worked out.
I feel that, man. Fiance soon to be.
Soon to be the wife, yeah.
Soon to be the wife. That's exciting. How do you guys meet?
So I was Mr. Alpha Phi, and I went to their bid day, which was going to be her freshman year. When they got their bids to be in whatever sorority, and she ended up being an Alpha Phi. After that, after her bid day, we actually had a party, if you could call it that. It was just like a small thing with just Alpha Phi at our house in Tucson. And I was showering from upstairs, and I came downstairs, and there was like two girls eating my dark chocolate covered espresso beans from Trader Joe's.
How dare they?
Unbelievable. Zero respect. And I approached him, and one of the girls was her, and I was just giving her crap for it, and you know, we just kind of hit it off, and you know, from there, I guess, as the term goes, it's history. So
wow.
Yeah,
that's
pretty funny. So
that's a romantic encounter.
Look, anyone who likes dark chocolate covered espresso beans has my heart. So
yeah, I guess we're not compatible. I don't like dark chocolate espresso beans.
That's a good thing we're not dating.
Dude, exactly. So, dude, what is going on? How are you?
I'm good, man. Just wiped. Obviously, just I was telling you, I just got back from that big trip in Asia. And we were in L.A. last weekend, got sick. Like, not sick, but it was like a little bug.
That always happens. When you got the most going on, you get sick at the worst times.
No matter how healthy you are.
Yeah.
Or no matter how careful you are with anything. It's inevitable. I mean, you go. Obviously up working late every night too, and it's inevitable. So
it just happens. I have a joke.
Had a 24-hour bug, and I sweated. I think I sweated it out in my sleep and woke up the next day feeling...
That's what you got to do. You just got to drain yourself in NyQuil.
That's it.
Sleep
yeah.
for like 15 yeah. to 18 hours, and you're good to go. That's typically.
I wish I could take NyQuil.
No NyQuil for you.
Can't do it.
I respect that. There's better alternatives. But it's funny. I have a joke.
I would if I could.
True. I guess I should ask why you can't take NyQuil.
I get sleep paralysis from that stuff. Like anything with like heavy melatonin.
Oh really?
Messes me up. Yeah.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, it's pretty... I don't really tell people because they're like, who are you?
Sleep paralysis, so what, like you like sleep for hours?
No, it's almost like hallucinating.
Oh, really?
Like I almost hallucinate. Like you're awake, but you're not dreaming, but like you're awake and hallucinating almost. It's very bizarre. And it's like you feel like you can't move. It's wild. I've met very few people that get it too.
That's scary.
Yeah. So
Yeah, it freaked
everyone
me
I
out.
talk to about it just looks at me like I'm a nut job. And then I meet one in a million people who get the same thing and they understand. But yeah, it's wild. So I have to avoid it, but
Damn. No, that's funny. I have a joke with one of my buddies. We were in Vegas for a conference. Like, it wasn't even for like the fun Vegas. It was still fun, but like it was for a different type of Vegas. And we're at this conference, and it was like kind of like a Grant Cardone, Tony Robbins type seminar.
but not
And
with them.
no, they were there.
Oh,
But
they were.
like,
Okay, cool.
yeah. Tony Robbins wasn't there, but it was like picture Tony Robbins. It was like that kind of crowd, business motivated
I
type.
love listening to Grant Cardone.
Dude, the Cardone zone all day.
Yeah.
And we're at this conference, and we leave like I'm hyped to get back to work.
For sure.
And then I go to another work conference for my actual job soon after, and I get sick right after that. And then I was telling my buddy that. He was like, "Dude, motivated people don't get sick." So now every time I get sick, he gives me shit. He's like, "Dude, you're just not motivated enough. What's going on?"
Yeah, you just gotta tell them it's allergies.
Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly. Dude, so you went to
that's so
China
funny.
recently?
I went to China recently for work. People always ask me, how great is it? I always say the best part for me is the flight there and the flight back.
Yeah, that's hard to believe.
I'll put it this way. If I had more time to explore and travel and really get outside and see what it's all about, I would have a completely different perspective. But we're there to work, sleep and eat whenever we can, and that's it. There's no time for anything else, especially being on the different time zones. I have 15 hours ahead for where we are located. It's really tough. It's really tough to not be completely exhausted at all times and have the motivation to get out at 8 p.m. at night, maybe 9 p.m. at night,
How often do you
China time.
travel like that for work?
Once a year, we go to China. So
That's not bad. That's still pretty cool.
it could be a lot worse. I'm kidding. I would love to go more because I think it would give me more time to actually explore. But let's put it this way. We get there usually late at night. So we get to our hotel. We're fairly exhausted from the flight. So maybe get some sleep in. Usually sleep for 4 hours or so just because the time difference just knocks us as soon as we get there. Next morning, we're up 6 a.m. I'm up at like 5:30, 6 a.m. I go to work out in, have a quick bite to eat, get in the car. Sit in rush hour traffic for 2.5, 3 hours before we get to a factory that's like actually an hour and a half away from where we are. But because of traffic, it adds that much time. Then we spend a couple hours at a factory. Then we get back in the car, hit traffic on the way back, same traffic. And then I'm working. Then we have another bite to eat for dinner. And then it's like, how do you even have energy to get out?
Yeah, that's a long day.
And that's repeat every single day for 7 days straight.
Yeah, that's a trip. That's a work trip.
It's a work trip for sure.
What
So
do you do that catalyzes a trip to China?
my family manufactures all the ergonomic office furniture for the online office furniture retailers and the contract furniture market. So that includes electric sit-stand desks. That includes all the different types of desktops that go on the frames. That includes monitor arms, mobile pedestals, power supply modules. I mean, you name it. We make a bunch of different stuff, and everything except for a couple products is made in Asia. We have one factory in Mexico, and we have one factory in Illinois, actually.
Wow.
But we private label, so everyone always asks me like, oh, I need a standing desk. Like, what's your website? And, we don't have a website because we, like I said, private label. So that means we put everyone else's logo on our product on the box, and our factory shipped directly to our customers. So we don't have to have stock and we don't have to touch money.
You're the
That's it.
middleman.
Yeah, we have, we are the factory. We work and work under and are employed essentially by our factories. But we have a lot of
connections and customers out here now that we're able to use that leverage to bring new factories on board and work with them exclusively. So
Wow.
yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, what? I work in sales, so, like, I try to think of everything as, like, a sales-driven process. Like, what would be the process to gain new clients if you're not putting if you're using other people's logo on your furniture?
So obviously we present everything without a logo, right? So
Okay, I see what you're saying.
everything's a blank canvas. So we show people
Yeah.
the products, they order samples. The only times that we'll put logos and anything on boxes and on product is when that customer orders, right? So if we ship them samples and they see pictures, there's no logos on it at all.
Got it. So essentially, your customers are like distributors.
Our customers actually consider themselves manufacturers because they put their name on it. So whereas we're the
Oh,
actual manufacturer, they actually also consider themselves furniture manufacturers.
again, the nerve. How dare they?
Zero respect. Yeah.
What's it like working for the family business?
It's an interesting dynamic for sure. Zero feelings involved. Zero
Yeah.
emotion involved, which is a really difficult thing, right? Because we all get emotional about things. We all get excited and down about things. And when you work in a family business, it cannot be that way. And it shouldn't be that way, truthfully, in any business, because when things get too emotional, you get tied up on them, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if you get too emotional about a potential order, a potential purchase order coming through, and it doesn't come through, which happens probably more than not in every industry,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
Because you can just never expect anyone to do the right thing. You know, if you're too emotional about it, then it's over. You know, your month is ruined. And I guess the nice thing about working in a family business is that there's not necessarily that pressure of a corporate structure held over your head that you have to meet a certain quota. It's just busting your ass to make ends meet and to make as many sales as you can, because in a family business, everyone's on commission, right? There's no salaries involved.
Yeah.
Is the way I look at
I
it.
feel like that would be nice though. I hear
It
what you're saying
is.
about the emotion, especially if it's your family, like dad, mom, why are you sleeping in late? We got work to do.
Yeah.
You know, like that can get frustrating. I mean, obviously that's an extreme example, but I feel like if you did, like the quota aspect and like the corporate structure, that gets stressful. Like I feel like there's a lot of times where people have internal company stress more than external customer facing stress.
For sure. And I would say 90% of the time it's that situation where
Yeah.
it's internal for sure. Because external, you know, like you can only say so much to your customer, right? But you can really say something to your superiors in your company if you're willing to. But I think that's where the struggle is. It's like, how willing are you to stand up for yourself?
Yeah. Have you
And
worked in a big corporation before?
I have, and it's not easy to stand up for yourself.
Yeah, no, I can speak from
So
experience.
that's the hard thing. They don't give you that option really to stand up for yourself, because it's like if you try, they rip you a new one, right? And you feel good about going into it, and then you feel even shittier leaving it than you did when you were going in. So that's, I think, where the struggle is, and I think that's why people are constantly churning in the companies that they're working for.
Do you have a personal experience that you can relate on?
In working for companies with internal struggles?
Yeah, just like knocking on your boss's door, be like, "Hey,
Oh, for sure.
let me hear it."
So, in college, I interned at Ralph Lauren Corporate in Manhattan.
No way.
And yeah, it was a sick job. Really, really fun. I was born in New Jersey. Half my family's in New York. So, regardless, I go back all the time. But interning there, I thought was going to be the best thing in the world, right? And I get there and we have our first like week or two where it's really just hanging out with the whole intern group and working together. And then the program starts. So we all go to our like respective corners essentially in different departments, right? So I'm in the sales and planning department for like all accessories, like leather accessories, so bags and belts and all that good Ralph Lauren stuff. And they had hired someone who had a family friend relation for my position that wasn't even in the intern program, wasn't even old enough to be in the intern program. They hired this girl. And I'm like, you know what? Like, screw it. I can only do this for so long where I'm like sitting at my desk watching someone else younger than me do my job. So I shot an email to one of the CFOs, and because you have a whole database of everyone in the company. So I shot an email to one of the CFOs in a completely different department. And I said, look, this is the situation. I'm more interested in what you're doing anyway. I said, let me know how I can help you out for a few months this summer. And I ended up working on some projects with one of the CFOs of Ralph Lauren pretty closely. And then my bosses, for what my job should have been, were kind of like, well, we're not going to talk to you now, really. And I explained to them, I said, look, you hired someone who is doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And that's not even in the intern group, who's 2 or 3 years younger than me. So I'm not just going to sit here because this is my only way now potentially in to work for the company. And they didn't understand that dynamic because corporate structure, and they don't like anyone going above them or stepping on their shoes. And I was just like, screw you, you know? It was cool. It was cool working for the CFO. I wouldn't say that that would happen all the time.
That's badass.
So, yeah, we worked on like one really, really big project together. And it's funny enough, I was going through just files on my computer the other day, and I found all these like very sensitive documents that I probably should have not had on my computer after I left the company. it's kind of fun to look at, but
yeah.
So that's just one way of how the corporate structure, it's like someone gets into a position, they're not the CEO, they're not even a C-level suite executive, yet they don't know how to do the right thing. They don't know how to even, I guess at that point, stand up for themselves, because it's kind of like, okay, we got to figure out a position for this kid now that we're hiring someone else, right? And then they don't know how to take the criticism. And that's when I really realized that I'm not going to work for them, even if they offered me a job. And that I have to be in business for myself in some sort of way.
And dude, that's quite the realization.
I shouldn't say that that was the fine, you know, defining moment for me that I knew that, because I always knew I wanted to be entrepreneurial in some sort of way. But that was a really good example of someone trying to fuck you over in the corporate world. And I'm sorry, I don't know if cursing.
You can curse on the podcast. It's all good.
Cool. So it's always a question that has to be asked. But, you know, you get screwed over. And I think it just goes back to that philosophy that you just can never expect someone to do the right thing, ever. You always have to try and fend for yourself and do what you think is best, and then fix the mistakes or the problems from there. Because you can't fix someone else's mistakes.
And that goes back to what you were saying of keeping the emotion out of it.
For sure. I was like, you know what? I could let this upset me and watch this young girl try and do my job, or I'll just go do something better. So now when it comes to family, emotions get a little different because you feel I'm the only employee technically in my family's business because we keep things super, super lean. And so you expect a lot from the beginning, and then you slowly realize it's like, okay, everyone's got to earn their share, and, you know.
You have a big family? Okay.
Even with family.
Do you have a big family?
Oh, yeah. Well, not super big, but decent. You know, I have two brothers. I have two sisters. You know, three of the siblings have spouses. I have three cousins total. So, you know, that's not a lot on that side. So I don't have a big extended family, I would say. I have a fairly big immediate family.
Is it like all hands on deck? The Steiner family, all, you know, let's make this happen.
You know, I'm the only one in the family business besides, it's actually just my dad and my uncle, so.
Oh, man. Wow. All right, that is super
like
lean.
I said, we keep things super lean.
Yeah.
But it got to the point for my dad and my uncle, they were like, you know, we're at capacity, so.
Well.
They needed someone, so.
Strength in numbers, but I feel like also more times than not, there's more efficiency with less people.
way more efficiency, way less communication that needs to be had, and easier decision making.
Yeah, you have no idea what it's like to be CC'd on an email where there's like 30 people involved, and then they're just filling up space in someone's inbox.
It's craziness.
It's an adventure.
Yeah, and then you have to scroll through all the ones they forgot to CC you on to see what's going on.
Yep, adding Jim just so he has awareness of what's going on. Adding Shelly just because, why not?
Yeah. Adding Andrew because don't want to leave anyone out.
Exactly. Dude, that's cool, man. Something I want to bring up is your experience working with Rover. That was like the first entrepreneurial endeavor that I knew of you that you were a part of in college. And
sure.
I can only imagine the learning lessons that you took away from that.
Yeah, lots of learning lessons and honestly so many red flags from the beginning that, you know, I should have realized, but you get too caught up in the moment and too caught up in the what ifs, or what if this happens, or, you know, what if, you know, this works out in this way, you know, too many what ifs to not keep moving along. But I should have seen the red flags that trumped the what ifs, for lack of a better term, from the beginning. But that's okay. It was a good experience. So so we were in the entrepreneurial school at U of A. And before summer had started, we were kind of, I guess, in the last semester of the previous year, we all kind of would get together maybe like once or twice a week, I can't remember, in school with the whole program for the entrepreneurship program to help us figure out what we wanted to maybe launch and the groups we wanted to get into. And I met a couple people and, you know, we kept in touch over summer. And ended up meeting, you know, before school had started, I think, and talking about this project. And it was like very official. You know, one of the partners who had the basic shell of the idea, you know, having to sign NDAs. And, you know, luckily my oldest brother's an attorney, so I didn't have to go too far to get a document read. But, so it seemed like very official, and we were like, okay, this is kind of interesting because everyone's going to be starting from the ground up. We're kind of coming in as like first level employee, not co-founder necessarily, but first level employees with equity, I guess. And so we went for it, and the concept was Rover. It was supposed to be what was called a social connection app, but really it was like 70% a dating app, 30% a app for people moving to new cities to find others with common interests. So girls who really love doing yoga could go on the app and find a group of girls that like doing yoga in the area and get together and actually meet people, which I thought was a really nice aspect of it, because that's difficult nowadays to meet people.
Especially in a new city too.
In a new city, for sure.
Yeah.
And any app that launches in a city is going to launch in New York, Boston, San Francisco, LA, Austin, Dallas, Phoenix, you know, the major cities, which are big. So I like that part of it. The other part was the dating app, which had a similar, I guess, aspect to it in terms of find people with similar interests. But it was split up into casual dating and serious dating. So you could decide, hey, I'm really just looking to meet some people I may be interested in. I'm not looking for anything serious, but it could lead to something serious. Or, hey, I'm really looking for a serious relationship. I need to settle down with someone. That type of thing.
Yeah.
So it was a really solid idea. But I guess all I will say is that any business can be a great idea. I mean, think of some of the most simple businesses that are out there right now. Like we were talking a few weeks ago about that company Backdrop Home.
Yeah.
They're changing the paint industry. Probably one of the most boring industries and the butt of every boring joke ever, right? Like watching paint dry. So it doesn't get more boring than paint, but they've made it fun. But my point is that it all comes down to the team. So any idea can be a great idea, but if you don't have the right team in place, it's going to be really, really hard to get something to fruition, you know? I don't want to say awful things about the business or really great things. You know, I really want to be even keeled since I'm not involved anymore and I don't even know if the business is still going or not. I guess, but to give a perspective of what things were like before I resigned, and I was the first one to resign, and then the rest of the company resigned, except for the main partner, after that. But the week that we were launching, instead of having all hands on deck, most of the launch I felt was kind of relying on me and my social network of people. While one kid was working on an employee handbook, I mean, we had four employees, like, you know, come on.
Yeah, this is the launch week. HR shouldn't necessarily.
No, what do we need HR for? You know, we don't have little fuckers running around an office, you know, working, you know. I don't even know.
I can picture this.
So that's what it was like. And we had some differences in the marketing ideas and stuff like that. And I just said, hey, you know, if I can't do what I know I'm good at and we have different ideas for this and I just can't see it going any further as a business, and take my equity that's worth nothing and just cut me a check for my time. That's it. So that's what happened. But overall, it was a good experience. I am happy I went through with it, because who doesn't want to know the process of starting an app? I mean, we got to design the whole thing on our own because we had some issues with a design company we were working with. So it actually ended up falling back on us and our designer, and all of us, we collaborated, and all of winter break, we were up till 12, 1, 2, 3 in the morning every night with each other on FaceTime and Skype, working on the app and just building it out. We had a board member who was also owner of a development shop, so that was nice. So they built out the whole back end.
Yeah, I was curious about that, because do you have knowledge in coding and engineering, software engineering?
Not at all. So like I was saying, we were lucky enough to have a board member who owned a development company.
Got it.
And you know, he did a really good job with building it out. There's always hiccups, and that's business. But he did a really good job with building it out, and he's very reputable. He's had some success in the past with other companies, so that was nice to have. But, you know, that's kind of one of those things. When starting a business, you can only know so much, right? Like, I mean, look at Zuckerberg. He was genius enough to be able to code Facebook and get the basic design out, which the design was very mediocre, I would say, of Facebook. It still kind of is, right? There's nothing special to it.
I kind of left Facebook. Kind of like said goodbye to the Facebook network.
I don't really go on anymore.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people are also following in those footsteps.
Yeah. It's just, it's too much. It's too much nonsense.
It's a distraction. You
know? It's becoming a place, honestly, for our parents to rant about politics.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I don't really care to see it anymore. So,
yeah.
You know, but my point is that he was very good to get the basic bones of the business, but then he obviously had to hire people to do the rest. So my philosophy is always, when it comes to starting a business, is outsource what you're not good at or bring people in. I mean, nothing like having an expert marketer, for example, come into your business if you're really good with finance and operations, right? I mean, give someone equity to come in and market your company. Every company now is marketing. This is just an example though, right? So my point is you should always outsource what you're not good at. You can't be good at everything to an efficient point.
You'll be spread too thin.
Too thin. There's not enough time. There's not enough manpower. You'll go nuts. You'll start throwing your head through a wall. And no matter how good you are, it's going to be a fairly mediocre product, because it's just, you can't spend enough time on everything. So let people in. Don't be afraid to give away equity. People are always interested in being a part of something if they're interested, you know?
Yeah. Do you have any, aside from your family business, are you on any other entrepreneurial paths of your own?
Yeah, I'd actually like to get out of my family business. It's, you know, you get an itch, and when you know you want to be entrepreneurial, I guess where I'm at now is I'm still pretty much in business for myself because I handle my own portion of the business and I run it. And so I rarely have to like talk to family about, you know, what's going on. You know, I keep them informed, but that's really it. But yeah, I'm always looking for new opportunities. My favorite thing to do is to find companies or opportunities that I'm interested in and reach out to them and say, hey, are you looking to get anyone involved? You know, are you looking to hire for equity? Are you looking for help with this? Are there any investment opportunities? Most of the time people say no, but that's the worst anyone's ever going to say. Right.
Yeah.
And that's how I try and go out to every business idea and every opportunity that I could potentially have. I look at it as the worst they're going to say is no. Obviously they could say it in different ways and tell you to go F off. But that's still a no.
And, you know, bringing it back to minute number one of the conversation, taking the emotion out of it, who cares?
Who cares?
Move on.
You don't know them and they don't know you. So, but yes, I am involved in some other business opportunities. My family actually doesn't know. So hopefully somewhere deep rooted into your following, there's no family members of mine, but
I don't think so.
I reached out to a company in New York called Charlie Street, long story short, and just said, hey, is there any investment opportunities? This is what I see the vision of the company as. This is where I see it going. This is where I see the growth, opportunities of the business, so on and so forth. I said, let me know if I fall in line with any of that. And shoot me an email back. And I said, and P.S., I'm not accredited probably by any means necessary in an investment opportunity. And they got back to me and they said, you know, your visions actually lie directly with what our plan is. Let's talk. So we got on a couple calls, a couple conference calls. I went out to New York. I made the mistake of mentioning it to my family. They called me every name in the book. You know, and I'll just leave it at, I haven't told anyone whether I'm involved or not involved, but I'll just leave it at that.
We'll leave it there.
But you know, I think that the funny thing is that half my family, my whole family's from New York.
Represent.
That's right.
New York strong, baby.
That's right. Always. So my whole family's from New York. My dad has always been very, very successful in business and has never had to invest a lot other than time to get his businesses and his life successful. He's never had to use a lot of cash. He's never had to be really risky. He's never had to take crazy opportunities. Obviously, everything's a risk when you're a business for yourself, but he's never had to take those financial risk opportunities to get going. And the other side of my family in New York that still lives there, that's in the car business, has had to do that and have been very successful doing so. So whereas one side of my family is very jaded, the other side of my family is very appreciative of that aspect of being an entrepreneur. So I told both sides of the family about it. My dad's side of the family was like, are you a fucking idiot? Like, you know, what is wrong with you? Where do you even get off trying to get involved in something like that? And then my other side of the family was like, 100%. If, you know, you need to seek out the deal and see what it looks like. And if it's fruitful, you're young, do it. The upside is way more than the loss. Don't worry about it, you know?
It's also kind of like a popular trend to do so these days. I feel like anywhere in the media that's directed towards young professionals, the idea of taking risk is very popular. You know, go out, sure. Drop out of college, start a business, become the new Mark Zuckerberg, become the new Steve Jobs.
For sure.
Don't become the new Theranos person. Elizabeth Holmes, don't be like her. But like,
yeah, don't change your voice.
Yeah. Don't do that, but yeah. Do something like that where, you know, take this giant risk, leap of faith, and then go start something. And
Or watch the upside and contribute where you can, because
Is that Kevin Hart movie?
What?
The Kevin Hart movie?
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't seen it. Is it good?
Dude, he's classic.
Oh, I love the guy.
He's classic.
I'll have to check it out then.
But yeah, I mean, look, like I said, nobody, I haven't said anything to really anyone, whether I've done it or not. I just kind of let it die out. And I'm following the business very closely and keeping in touch, and things are going really well with them. So, you know, it is what it is. Fortunately, you can't involve everyone that you want to involve in everything unless you're willing to get everyone's negative opinion.
Yeah, which I'm curious, because now that the negative opinions that you're receiving were from your family, you know, the people that matter most in your life, how do you take that emotion out of that and continue to move forward logically?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, but it's one of those things that you can't get too attached to again, right? If you believe in something enough and you know that something can work and it looks good on paper and you can handle it and everything checks all the boxes for you, or at least the majority of the boxes, right? Then you should move forward with it and not worry about what people say, because everyone's always going to give you their opinion. A lot of times it comes out of jealousy too. I mean, family or not, it just does. And I hate to say that, because I'm not trying to like tout myself or tout anyone else or situations that I'm involved in or not. But it does, because everyone wants to be an entrepreneur. Everyone wants to have that risk inside their gut. There's very few people that don't want to be in business for themselves deep down, or want to have that entrepreneurial lifestyle or mindset. They're, just be honest.
Which is the idea of building something spectacular, something that you can look back and be proud of.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's like the most appealing thing in the world.
For sure. There's too many unicorn businesses out there right now that everyone is a part of in terms of our daily lives and what we use, that you don't want to be a part of something like that. And I think a lot of it does come from jealousy, not from a standpoint of like, oh, you have the means to do this or you don't have the means to do this. More so from a standpoint of, gosh, I really want to do something like that. I just don't have the balls. And that's kind of the way I look at it.
That's conversation too, yeah.
You know, and it's okay. I just, like I said, I don't let it get to me. It gets to me probably for about like a day, because it makes me rattle my brain. And then I start looking at things again, and I start, you know, checking off the boxes, and I start going, yeah, this makes sense. There's no reason that I shouldn't do this other than if I'm $1 away from bankruptcy. You know what I mean? So if there's a will, there's a way. And if you can get over what everyone else's opinion is, then you're solid. And my best advice is don't involve anyone. It's fun to talk about shit, and it's fun to get people involved and get them excited about what you're doing. But you know what? Everyone's always going to give their opinion, and it's 99% of the time not going to be something you want to hear. And if you have any sense of reading anyone's lips, you're really going to get an idea for who's actually happy for you and who's not. And I just would rather not keep anyone involved, because it has nothing to do with them.
I love that.
And that's, I guess
that's some unpopular advice.
Kind of morbid in a way, like not involving family in my life, but every family has a different dynamic. I know people whose families are like, go and spend every dollar you have to start a business. If it's going to work, go for it. I'm happy for you. I'm proud of you. Then there's families who are like, save, don't spend money. Don't be an idiot. Don't fuck up. Get a job. Like, work for the family business. Be steady your whole life. Like, that type of shit. And very rarely are there parents that are like, no, you should go out and you should get involved in as much as you can, versus the parents that are like, no, you know, that's expensive. You need to save. You need to, you know, think about your future. And it's like, well, I am in a different way. I slowly have weeded things out that I involve people in. I make the decisions for myself, and then when I feel ready to tell people, I tell them.
Man, I admire that. That's really cool. Something I want to ask you is about your childhood and the upbringing, because you grew up in New York or Scottsdale?
I was born in New Jersey. I lived there for a very, very short period of time. But I primarily grew up in Scottsdale. But my parents were divorced, so I went back and forth between my mom moved to New Jersey, back to New Jersey. I went back and forth between Scottsdale, New Jersey, and New York, like, all the time. And having a whole family from the East Coast, no matter where you live, your household is like you might as well be growing up in Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know what it's like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, so, that's interesting. And did they instill these entrepreneurial values in you, either if it was from one side of the family or from the other, regardless? Or did you partake in any, like, business ventures as a kid, like selling chocolates down the block to the neighborhood or anything like that?
Funny enough, so I always realized that my family was entrepreneurial because I always knew that they were in business for themselves, whether I actually knew what they were doing or not. I knew that my grandfather was very entrepreneurial because he had a, you know, big car business in New York that's still around that my uncle runs now. And I always admired his entrepreneurial spirit because he would always tell me the story of how the business got started. And then I always knew my dad was an entrepreneur because of he was always at home. He always had his own business. He always worked from home. So growing up, not understanding business fully, I always knew that my family was in business for themselves, for whatever that's worth or whatever that meant. But like I said, again, my dad was very conservative, very frugal, spent money on the necessities. That was it. My mom's side of the family, complete opposite. Enjoyed the money that they had. Didn't blow it all by any means, but enjoyed it. So I saw both sides. But I knew that there was something fruitful in being in business for yourself. And I knew that as time went on and I got a car and I got a job and, you know, I knew that I'd have to pay my own bills. But I guess even before that, in the eighth grade, we sold gum in middle school because they wouldn't allow us to chew it. So
this is like a rule that was instilled within your school?
Yeah, they wouldn't allow it.
Oh, no way. Yeah, let me hear the story.
So a group of us got together and we were like, everyone wants gum all the time, but they don't let us sell it. And we were like, so let's figure out a way to just sling it from our backpacks. So we would get the gum in bulk and we'd sell either a pack or a piece. And it just blew up. I mean, we were making cash hand over fist. We ended up like the school started to somewhat find out. They started to like keep an eye out for us, but we kind of just did it under the table.
No way.
And we got one of our teachers involved who was like, you know, he was like the fun teacher that everyone wanted to have. And we told him, look, what can we do so we can sell the gum in class? And he was like, I want hush money and I'll let you guys sell in class, but I don't want money from you guys because I like what you're doing. I like that you're hustling. He's like, I want candy bars. So we'd buy him candy bars and whatever candy he wanted, and he'd let us sell the gum in class. Like, we would have kids that weren't even in his class coming to his class when it was over, and we would be doing gum deals in his class, giving him hush candy. We ended up making like a few grand each within a few months, and that was like just the craziest thing.
That's epic.
And then in high school, we made custom snapbacks, and, you know, we knew everyone would want them, but we're like, let's just try and sell out before we even get them, so we don't even have to, you know, pay the purchase order with our own money. So we started marketing them, and we ended up like selling out the hats before the market day, is what it was called, was over, or before it even started, rather. And to that date, I don't know if it still stands, but we made the most money out of anyone in the high school ever, in the history of the high school, selling these hats. So
this was just a knack for you. Like, you were just always a part of these groups of people just doing entrepreneurial ventures. Like, that is so cool.
For sure.
That was not taught in my high school. It was like sports.
Then by the time college came around, I had the option at one point to – I was lucky enough to always have my bills covered and my school covered, and I'm very grateful for that. But I've never not worked. You know, like in high school, I always had jobs. Like I worked at Allstate Insurance in high school.
That's a good job for a high school kid.
It was fun. It was very basic clerical work, but it was a good experience to learn that side of things. But in college, it got to the point where I had a option to find some sort of income and figure it out, or I could start a business for myself and make money. So I was doing the t-shirts and all that for my fraternity. I was also like the social chair, so I was kind of handling both. And one of my pledge brothers came up to me and he said, "Hey, my buddy's starting this clothing company. You should talk to him. Maybe he can make the shirts for us." And I ended up talking to him and he's like, "You know, I'm really looking to kind of bring in like a partner for the business. Like I have a partner in Chicago who just kind of handles things like, you know, on the back end, but I'm looking for a partner to help me run this." And I was like, "Okay." And he was like, "I'll tell you what, if you can sell like X amount of dollars in clothing in the next like couple months, I'll make you a partner in the business." I said, "Sure, no problem." I went out and I ended up like tripling or quadrupling the number that he gave me. I think the number he gave me was like 25 grand or something like that, which at the end of the day isn't a ton when it comes to bulk apparel sales. And I ended up like tripling or quadrupling that number and became a partner of the business. And we ended up doing like all the fraternities and sororities clothing, or for the most part, we did at U of A. We did a lot at ASU, a couple schools on the East Coast, a couple schools in California. We started marketing this thing called $2 Tuesdays for a bar on campus called Gentle Ben's. So we were getting marketing consulting fees from them. We ended up doing about 500K in sales in the 2.5 years that I was doing it.
No way. How do you do that?
And
Like when you went out to go, like you weren't selling a shirt by shirt, you were doing this all in bulk, so you were just forming partnerships with other organizations and running their apparel.
yeah, we were just like, "Hey, you know," because the thing is that like all the fraternities and sororities were already outsourcing their clothing that they wanted to make for events and whatever it may be. They were already outsourcing it to some other third party. And we were like, "Hey, we're at U of A. Like, why not use us? You can talk to us whenever you want. I literally live on your street. Like, I live in my fraternity house down the street from you. You can call me at any time and we can do this together." And they're like, "Yeah, sure, that sounds good." You know, they don't give a shit. And we ended up just creating relationships. We didn't have a website. We just had good partners to do all the printing and all that. And it just really worked out. We just started crushing the sales, and we just ended up being some of the go-to people. We didn't do every deal, but we did most of them. And people still text me all the time, and I'll do them on the side. I don't really have a business for it, which is probably not good, but like I just did a whole custom basketball jersey order for a group of kids in California, just like on the side. But you know, it's fruitful enough that it makes sense. If it was t-shirts and stuff like that, I wouldn't do it. But the jerseys, it makes sense because they're expensive to begin with. So,
Wow.
but that partnership, you know, fizzled out, and I left the company. And you know, that's the way business goes. But they ruined a good thing, you know.
Interesting.
They tried to screw me out of equity. I was really the only one running the business because the other two people weren't even at the school anymore. One guy was like way older than us and wasn't doing anything. He shouldn't have even gotten a dollar. And then the other kid was at U of A with us, but then he had graduated. But even then, I was the one making all the relationships on campus, doing all the selling. All that. And so they tried to screw me out of money and equity, and I didn't let them screw me out of money, at least. But I was like, you know, I'm not gonna be. Then they were asking me to be in business with them after they tried to screw me out of equity, and I was just like, are you kidding me?
Jeez. Man, you should write a book on all these lessons learned.
Yeah, if there was anyone who wanted to read it.
They'll listen to the podcast. They'll get the Cliff
Yeah,
Notes.
exactly. Yeah, this is all I need.
Something I want to bring up is the premise of the podcast. I don't even know if I fully introduced it to you.
Yeah, go for
This is called Only Half the Story. So my last name is Half, so it fits right
right.
in. And we're talking to passionate people as they're in the pursuit of achieving their goals and dreams. And I recently made this podcast into a fundraiser. So sure. Now it's like literally a penny. That's how much my sponsors pay me. Every penny that is earned from the podcast, I'm donating it to a nonprofit here in the Bay Area. It's called Safe Space, an effort to support mental health.
Cool.
And I'm curious, based off all of your previous experiences, all of your entrepreneurial endeavors, I'm curious, where do you see mental health playing as a priority for everything that you do?
First and foremost, I mean, mental health isn't something to take lightly. I think our lives are a culmination of all these experiences that we have, and your mental health can be affected by sometimes when you're born. It could be affected sometimes when you're in the middle of your teens. It could be affected, you know, it could affect you when you're in your 50s. Like, people that go through a terrible divorce their mental health is affected terribly sometimes, you know? So I think that no matter where you are, I think being aware of what your surroundings are and being able to take a step back and deal with a situation can really help you digest what's going on. I tend to let a lot of things build up because I don't like to vent always to people, even though I need to do that because it's good for you. I tend to let a lot of things build up, right? And then all at once, sometimes it just bugs the shit out of me. I think as long as people can take in on a day-to-day basis everything that's happening, everything that they're dealing with, and be able to digest it from 14 different angles and say, I can go at it this way, I can take it in this way, I see where they're coming from, I don't see where they're coming from, talk to those. I think people who don't have mental health, that mental health problems that they're born with, right? I think that those can be avoided very easily. But it's hard to stay sane sometimes, especially if you work from home even, right? Like, I work from home.
Oh, yeah. Same here.
So on the weekends, like, my fiance is at work in an office with other people all week, right? So she gets home, and on the weekends, she just wants to lay and veg out, hang out and watch shows and drink coffee. And I'm all about that. But at some point, I'm like, I got to get out.
Yeah.
And not that in any sort of way should relate to mental health, because that's obviously not really in correlation. But I think it's more so from a standpoint of being aware of your surroundings always and being able to digest situations and the different people that you deal with and see everything from all angles can really help the future of your mental health evolve to react certain ways to situations, because at one point you're really going to see it all, right? At one point in our lives, we're going to have seen it all. And our parents tell us that all the time, that, you know, I've seen it all. So I think the more that we learn and the more that we adapt to certain situations in our lives, we're going to be able to deal with them later on. And I think that truthfully plays a huge role in mental health and especially for me. And I know that there's a million other ways to go about that answer, but that's really the way that I look at it from a standpoint of people that aren't battling those issues right now.
So it's just always auditing your mental state here and there when necessary.
Always, because if you have to be aware, because there gets a certain point, and I don't know if you're starting to notice it, but I'm starting to see it in my parents. Like, there's just a certain age where they just don't give a shit anymore, and they think certain things are okay, and they think certain things are not okay. And I think if we don't take that in and notice things like that, I think we're never aware.
Yeah. Right?
And I think awareness is really one of the first steps to overcoming mental health.
I like it. I like it a lot. That's some wise words.
Just the way I look at it.
Yeah. What do you say we start wrapping this up and asking away some rapid fire questions?
Let's do it.
All right. First rapid fire question. If you were to recommend a book to anybody imaginable, what book would that be?
Oh man, can I do two?
Yeah.
All right. First book is Made in America, Sam Walton's book.
Oh, I like that book. I read that a while ago. Yeah.
I think and I'll just say a little thing about it real quick, is that the fact that he was so active in the business and in all of his stores until the day that he had passed is a testament to why they're still the company they are. I think without that, they would have been gone probably a couple of years ago when they were starting to struggle a little
bit.
Dude,
he would crawl on his hands and knees and measure the length between aisles.
Dude,
within his competitors. Like, he would go to, like, a Kmart, like, on a Saturday afternoon, go on his hands and knees and, like, measure the length of how far apart their aisles were and compare them to what their Walmart stores were. It's insane.
Yeah, and that's why he was successful. The second book I'd recommend is The Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Okay.
I don't know if you've read it.
I have not.
It's by Ben Horowitz of Andreessen Horowitz, the VC firm. But it essentially is a book about him and all of his, the incredible and successful business experiences that he's had. But it really gives you a back end look to what it's like being a CEO of a startup company that grows very quickly, very successfully, and then is about to die at hour zero and they have to figure their shit out. It just really gives you a perspective, and it's very informative for people that are somewhat in business for themselves. And it's a phenomenal book, and he's a really good writer and storyteller. I would have to say that's my second one. I have a whole bookshelf back there of books that I just know that I've wanted, and so I haven't even read them yet, but I bought them just to keep them on cue.
There's something fun about buying books. I'm kind of the same way. I got a bookshelf right behind me as well. I'm actually looking at it right now, and there's at least like four or five that I just purchased just for the sake of purchasing them, and they're on the list.
Yeah.
I'll get them.
I wish that they still put books in the cool leather bound, antiquarian style.
Yeah.
Because it would look much cooler on a bookshelf. But
yeah.
I guess you can take the dust jackets off and they'll be hardcover still, but
that's pretty cool. All right, next rapid fire question. If you could host a dinner party and you can invite anybody imaginable, who would you invite? What would you make and why?
Oh man, I know what I would make. I would for sure make my mom's homemade fresh tomato sauce, just because you can't go wrong. Let the people get messy. Let their clothes get stained.
it's a party.
The people that I would invite would be the CEOs of some of the companies that I love the most, like Warby Parker, obviously Amazon. I mean, I hate to use a cliche like that, but Warby Parker, Away, Travel, companies like that. I would invite the CEOs before they started their businesses.
Wow. Dude, that's like the premise of this podcast.
Yeah. I would invite them before that they had started their businesses or formulated their ideas, because then I'd be involved.
Yeah. Wow. All right. I love it. That's quite the answer. And that last rapid-fire question, we're going to bring it back to the premise of the podcast one last time. This is called Only Half the Story for two reasons. One, my last name is Half, so it fits right in. And two, we're talking to passionate people as they are in the pursuit of achieving their goals and dreams, similar to exactly what you just said. I feel like we oftentimes listen to these types of conversations, and the featured guest is this quote-unquote successful individual, and they have all the answers and this grand story to tell on how they got to where they are. But I'm trying to reverse engineer that and dig out the tangible steps of those who are actually doing it, who are on the pursuit, who are on the journey, and dig out the tangible lessons along the way. And with that being said, Cameron, thank you so much for hopping on Only Half the Story podcast. It means the world. And last rapid fire question, how do you want to put your stamp on the universe?
How?
Yeah.
I think for me, it's always been about starting a company that I enjoy to the point where it's not work. I can give back to the community, and I can provide for family and anyone else that is close to me that's in need. I think that is my way of putting my stamp on the universe. It's always been about that for me. That mindset will never change, whether it happens or not. It's a goal. And I think that at the forefront of everything. If you can provide for your family and give back to those in need in the community, then you've done your job.
I love it, man. I love it a lot. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, buddy. Good seeing you.
And there you have it, Chapter 42, Put It in the Bank with the one and only Cameron Siner. If you are feeling this episode and you are digging this podcast, please like, subscribe, share this with the universe. You might as well. It's all going to charity. Every time you listen to an episode of this show, 3 pennies will be donated to safespace.org in effort to support mental health. My name is Andrew Haft. This is Only Half the Story Podcast, and we will see you next time.